This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Lucy Hockings from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at disinformation online and its potential influence on the upcoming US presidential election. Why people fall for online conspiracy theories and what happens when real-world events are shaped by online disinformation. And how AI could affect the result of next month's election. The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning. So, the PS and I have been in touch with The Nolan Show talking about the latest security assessment around the Army Council. That's coming up in this programme. The traffic chaos, bedlam that there continues to be in Belfast. The Nolan Show continuing to cover it. And then at the cinema, in bed, with the etiquette expert, William Hansen. Only that mix could be on the biggest show in the country. All coming up.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning. In recent weeks, the ministers Paul Given and Gordon Lyons, both DUP ministers, have been under pressure because they met the LCC. The LCC is a group which represents the views of the UDA and the UVF. Both Paul Given and Gordon Lyons might be very interested in the police assessment which has been given to the Nolan Show this morning. And that PSNI assessment is that the Army Council still controls Sinn Féin, and the following. And let's just think about this very carefully as we walk through this. The current assessment, the 2024 assessment from the PSNI, is that some IRA members are involved in gathering information such as details of dissident Republican activity. Now, why would the IRA, if it's disappeared, be gathering that information? What are they doing with it? Attempting to identify covert human intelligence sources. An instruction from the Army Council to do that? Once again, think of this in the context of that Army Council, the PSNI say the assessment is 2024, it's up to date. That Army Council controls Sinn Féin, the political party that is creating legislation in Northern Ireland. That same Army Council, according to the PSNI, is still, 2024, involved in the storage of weaponry to prevent it falling into dissident Republican hands. So the IRA are storing weapons? Where? Why? How does Sinn Féin feel about this? Presumably, they must agree with it because they're being controlled by the body that's storing the weapons, according to this report. Now, it's very important to highlight that this same report does say that the Provisional IRA of the Troubles era is well beyond recall. It is very important to say that the leadership remains committed to the peace process and its aim of achieving a united Ireland by political means. And the group is not involved in targeting or conducting terrorist attacks against the state. It's quite similar, is it not, to what the LCC would say about UDA and UVF, is it not? They're not conducting terrorist attacks against the state, UDA, UVF. You've heard Jim Wilson, who an attorney with the Red Hand Commando, that's how he calls himself. You heard him say over recent days that the leadership of these organisations are committed to the peace process. That's quite similar, is it not, to what we're being told by the PSNI is the status of the Army Council. So how similar are they? And is there this disconnect in public discourse between how society now views the IRA and how society views the UDA and UVF? You might say to yourself, well, hold on a second. The UDA and the UVF are still involved in criminality. But the PSNI telling us this morning that the IRA, some members are remain involved in criminal activity, large-scale smuggling. So the IRA is involved in criminal activity as well. Some members, just like we hear, some members of the UDA and UVF. John Mooney is joining us this morning, security correspondent for the Sunday Times. Good morning to you, John.
Good morning, Stephen.
So look, when we were coming into work this morning and last night when we were discussing this, we were saying, does there need to be an official assessment of where the Army Council is currently at? The PSNI have given it to us this morning. They say 2024, this is the up-to-date assessment, John.
Well, that doesn't surprise me at all, actually. And in many ways, the governments, both the Irish and the British governments, and I suppose you could say the American government as well, that this issue has been fudged. Now, they would argue that it was fudged deliberately and for good reason, insofar as that it suited many agendas to have that organisation remain intact as best it could, given that there had been a number of splits within it that produced, I suppose most notably, the Real IRA, which went on to engage in quite serious terrorism, and we're all aware of the sort of the loss of life that was happened at OMA in August 1998. So to hold the organisation, the Provisional IRA as it was in place, and to have some sort of structure over it, I think that was something that suited lots of different agendas.
But this is exactly, John, sorry to cut across you, but this is exactly what some of the leadership representing the UDA and UVF are saying. It's exactly what they're saying.
And there's probably a good argument for that as well. Though I think what we've seen in recent years, particularly with loyalism, and I think this is really important to remember, and also Republican paramilitaries who are pro-peace processes, as in the INLA, that some of those groups have morphed into what are known as hybrid organisations. They're both criminal and terrorist in nature. So, for example, the INLA does not pose a threat to the police, but it certainly poses a threat to the people in Northern Ireland and people living in the Republic, because it's heavily involved in organised crime and doesn't really have any political ideology to it anymore. Elements of loyalism have now drifted, went through that same process. And whilst they support the peace process, and they openly state that, the truth of the matter is that various factions within those organisations are really now just criminals and nothing else. And that's a recognised phenomenon that happens in peace process environments.
So what is your assessment, John, of the difference then between those loyalist paramilitary groups, let's look at the UDA, UVF, and the Provisional IRA?
So it's all individuals, Stephen. There are people within loyalism that are committed to the peace process and would run a million miles away from drug trafficking and all the social ills associated with it. However, there are others who don't. The Provisional IRA, it's a little bit more, it's slightly more individualistic and it's slightly different. The Provisional IRA has sort of been subsumed by Sinn Féin, and people within that caretaker organisation exist within Sinn Féin, and some of them are not in Sinn Féin, it should be stated, and to a large degree have given up their involvement in crime, as in for the organisation, but there are many of them are now involved in crime and have been involved in crime for a very long time, and their lives surround their whole social identity is built around being involved in smuggling and everything else. But they're doing it for their own self-enrichment. It's not for an organisation, if that makes sense.
Structurally, the orders, if you like, coming from the Army Council, if we take what the PSNI have said this morning, that this most recent, the 2024 assessment from them, and we're being briefed that it's MI5 does the assessment, not the PSNI, but that they work closely with them, is what we're being given to understand, is that the IRA are continuing to store weaponry to prevent it falling into dissident Republican hands. So they're not handing it over to the authorities. They're not destroying it. They're storing it, John. Now, why would they be doing that?
Because these organizations, and this is what no one really likes to say about them, they want to continue to exist. They pay lip service to the notion that they're disbanding and everything else, but they really want to exist, and I often think that if the governments were slightly bit more novel, they would maybe license some of this, or in terms of trying to dissuade people from getting involved in it. But people that generally, when they've been involved in these organizations, they have a loyalty to them. It's part of their tradition. It's part of their social identity. And so there's a whole lot of things going on with them. And they tend to want to remain part of that organization because it is an illicit underground organization. It works for them. They're not particularly interested in joining the Lions Club or something else like that, or a retirement club. This is what they're into.
Former leader of the Ulster Unionist Party, non-MLA, let's talk about him in his present day, right, Doug Beattie, is also with us this morning. Just one final question before I go to Doug, John. Can you then understand the frustration that we've heard articulated on the airwaves over recent days from people representing some of these views of the UVA-UVF, saying there's a complete disconnect in the conversation in Northern Ireland between the Army Council, who control Sinn Féin, and the discourse about the UDA and UVF?
I completely understand that, and they are right. And I'm going to say something that's probably very unpopular, but these type of groups have existed on the island of Ireland for the past 300, 350 years, and they will probably still exist in 350 years' time also. I spend a lot of my time studying these groups and doing academic research into them, so I know the scene. They've been around for a long time, and they're not going away anytime soon. I think the government's adopt a pragmatic approach to them, where they're trying to encourage them to cease their activities. But again, Stephen, it's important to remember what you're dealing with here. Many of these groups have become, they're many things to many men. People get involved in them for lots of different reasons. Some of it's power, some of it's social identity. Some of them, it gives them a reason to get up in the morning. That's kind of difficult to understand for someone that has a job and is busy and raising children and everything else. But they're not going away anytime soon. And anyone who points out the hypocrisy of maybe criticising politicians for engaging with the LLC, and then sort of, you know, pointing the finger at the existence of the IRA still, they're entirely correct, and they're entirely justified to have that opinion, but it still doesn't change the facts.
Stay there just a couple more minutes, John, if you can. Doug Beattie joining us now this morning. Good morning to you, Doug.
Morning, Stephen.
So does this set a different context now that the PSNI has confirmed this morning around Paul, the likes of Paul Given and Gordon Lyons meeting with the LCC? Who are you meeting when you're meeting Sinn Féin?
Well, I don't think it sets a different context, Stephen. It sets out what I've been saying for a long time, and my party's been saying for an awful long time, that all of these people need to go, and they need to leave. Now, the interesting thing which you're saying today is, since 2015, when the initial statement came out about the IRA Army Council still in existence and purely for peaceful means, I've been asking the question many times since, and I've had answers verbally and written, and they've said that 2015 assessment stands. And what you've got now pretty much says that 2015 assessment stands. But what is different is that intelligence gathering is not for peaceful means. What's it for? We need to find out what they're intelligence gathering for. And the second one is that they're saying they're storing weapons. So why are they storing weapons? That is not for peaceful means. So actually what we've got from 2015 is the...
And criminal activity.
Exactly. And therefore, what we've got from 2015 It's not the status quo now in 2024, but we've got things that have got worse in regards to the Army Council. And the Army Council is not the military wing of Sinn Féin. Sinn Féin is the political wing of the IRA Army Council. They take their direction from them. And we should be absolutely concerned. And what we should be getting now is Sinn Féin coming out today, the First Minister coming out today and saying, if the IRA have any weapons, they need to hand them over to the police now, today. And if they don't do that, Stephen, then they are complicit in this.
Is that realistic, John, to even expect that question to be answered?
They wouldn't answer it, or it would be fudged. They just simply wouldn't get into that. I think the IRA or the provisional movement, the best way of describing this, Stephen, in some ways, is I spoke to someone once, and it was about the last murder they carried out, which was, in, as you referred to there, in 2015. And someone said to me, do you think that's the last person they'll kill? And I kind of went, well, I don't know. And but they kind of said, well, there's your answer. The Provisional IRA, although it is on a peaceful track and it's just a shadow of itself and it wouldn't have the capability to engage in any sort of terrorism, it still retains the ability to kill. And that's part of the subculture that is violent republicanism. They want to retain that.
Doug Beattie has just said that, you know, first of all, Sinn Féin would say they are a political party in their own right and they seek a mandate and get that mandate both north and south. Doug Beattie has just stated, John, that Sinn Féin is the political wing of the IRA. When people, be it community groups, be it others, are meeting Sinn Féin, are they meeting a political party, or ultimately, if it's a big decision, are they meeting a party that the decision will be made by the Army Council?
So I'm going to answer this the best way I can. They're, in, I'd say, the vast majority of cases, meeting a political party. I think if it concerned an issue such as the border poll, I think people within the IRA would have some input into that.
Well, let me make it really up to date, John. So with the McMonagall case, there were two press officers, Sean McGeer and Keelan McGillan, McGinley, who wrote references for McMonagall when he had been suspected, not found guilty, but suspected of child abuse. Would the Army Council have made the decision that McGeer had to leave the party, or would Michelle O'Neill have had the freedom and Mary Lou McDonald to make that decision themselves?
I couldn't actually answer that question because I don't know.
But it's an important question, isn't it?
No, it is, but I would suspect, and this is only suspicion on my behalf, that Republican culture sometimes can lead people to maybe look after it, people that you perceive to be part of the wider Republican family. And that sort of loyalty can overshadow anything else. And that's just something that is endemic throughout the Republican community, as in the hardcore Republican community. So that particular incident that happened about those references, many people were shocked and surprised at that. It didn't really shock anyone who's familiar with the internal workings of the Republican community.
Doug Beattie, if we take this as read, because the PS and I were expecting this question, this is a considered response by them. That 2015 assessment, they say, still stands. They will have gone through what that means. It means that there are weapons out there somewhere being stored by the IRA. How many weapons? Why are the police trying to find them? Or is that just crazy? Well, are we just in a society, realpolitik of Northern Ireland, where there's no way the police will even try to look for them? It would upset the apple cart. So the weapons are out there somewhere.
Yeah, and what weapons are they? Where did they come from? Are they new weapons? Are they old weapons? Which side of the border are they on? Is the Garda Síochána involved in looking for these as well? There's so many questions to be answered about this, but the clear point is this, is that the IRA have retained weapons. What for? Sinn Féin are inextricably linked to the Army Council, so they need to be coming out and making it clear. I would be absolutely clear, Stephen. I'm a unionist politician, and I'll say to the UVF, the UDA, Red Hat Commando, or any other paramilitary group, if you have weapons, get them handed over right now. There's no reason to have them. So if I can do that as a politician, then Sinn Féin could do that as politicians, but regardless of what how embarrassing it might be for them.
But if you are waiting, if you're prepared, which you are, to sit down and work with and talk about all different policy issues, Doug, housing, roads, health, education, with Sinn Féin, if it's your stated position this morning that you believe Sinn Féin is the political wing of an active IRA, you're in the executive, therefore, with the political wing, these are your words, not mine, of the IRA, then surely you should be talking yourself housing, education to the UVF and UDA, should you not?
Look, every single time that I talk to, and I have spoken to various different groups, every time it is about you need to disband. When I speak to Sinn Féin, I'm telling you the same, it applies to them. Whatever influence they have over that terrorist group, they need to use that to get them to absolutely disband, because they are an insidious element to our politics here in Northern Ireland. That's a fact. Now, we've all always known that Sinn Féin has been linked to the Army Council. People have hidden from it, but I can't stop voters voting for them. That's outside of my control. And as long as they're allowed to exist, and they are, and they're voted for, which people do, there's nothing I could do about it.
There is a question here for John Boucher, the new Chief Constable, and the police statement that they're putting into the public domain this morning, John. How could it be possible that the assessment nearly 10 years ago, nearly a decade ago, is exactly the same 10 years later? That's what they're saying. How could that be possible, that nothing has changed?
I don't believe that's probably... Maybe, Stephen, if I could answer like that, that assessment that was published and put into the public domain, I think there's probably been annual assessments ever since, and that will be just routine work for the British Security Services in Northern Ireland, and the guards would do the same. So these issues will be continuously monitored to a degree. It's just that information may not be put in the public domain, but I'm absolutely out of no doubt, and only a fool would believe that these issues are not monitored continuously.
So does it mean they're not, I don't want to, are they telling us the truth?
I think they are.
When they say the assessment is now accurate in 2024.
I think it's obviously updated, but governments and their security agencies don't disclose intelligence on an ongoing basis. In some European countries, such as Germany, they release an annual threat assessment which sets out everything from organised crime to the actions of hostile states. Britain and Ireland and some other countries don't do that. So the security services in each country just doesn't release that information.
The 2015 assessment said security agencies judge that the Provision IRA has not conducted organised procurement of new weaponry in the period since the last IMC report of 2011. Well, why would they need new weaponry if they're storing weaponry to provide it from falling into dissident Republican hands? And why does that report talk about organised procurement?
Well, I presume organised procurement would be focused on new types of weapons that would be appearing across the world in terrorist hands and groups like this. So the fact that they wouldn't be seeking to acquire new types of weapons, maybe new designs for, you know, improvised explosive devices or whatever, would indicate that they are sitting on various materials that they have, but they're not trying to, I suppose, increase their capabilities or anything like that.
I have one final question for each of you. John, I'll ask this question of you. The ordinary punter on the street at the moment, me, everyone listening this morning, is it just the way of life in Northern Ireland that we've got to get into our head, these organisations, they're holding guns, they're holding weaponry, they're sitting in the background just in case, but they've no intention of going back to the old days, but none of them have gone away, you know. Is that where we're at?
I think that's correct, Stephen, even though no one really wants to say it aside from someone like yourself. But I think the danger in all of this is, and where people are possibly missing the more significant issue, is that paramilitarism in Northern Ireland, forget about those that oppose the peace process, but it's evolving in such a way it's become part of the culture that particular region, insofar as that if you live in certain areas, the presence of paramilitary groups is, they're just there. It's a blight on society up there, and no one seems to be able to do anything about it. And the real problem with this is that those subcultures, those violent traditions that exist, that some of them are evolving into fully fledged criminal organisations now that are involved in all sorts of criminal activities that make those who live in those communities, life for them, very, very difficult. And I think that's only going to get worse for lots of different reasons. And that is an anomaly that was, or an issue that was ignored during the peace process for the sake of peace. But I think the long-term consequences of that on society across Northern Ireland has yet to be fully understood.
John, thank you for your time this morning. John Mooney from the Sunday Times. Doug Beattie, final question to you. If John's assessment is right, they're not going away. In fact, they're going to get even more powerful. Then, as unpalatable as the question sounds, do we try to keep them on board and on a peace footing?
Look, I'll use a quote from my party leader. He says, this can't be as good as it gets. We can't just sit back and say, this is the lot in our life and just accept this. We must keep working to try and get rid of these people. We must keep working.
But does that mean engaging with them, Doug?
We engage with them. The point is, engage with them. Engage with them to get them to move on is what you need to do. Don't engage with them to give them relevance. There's the problem. If you give them relevance, why would they want to go away, Stephen? So you have to engage with them. Help them. Do what you can. And I'm willing to do that with anybody to get them to go away. But we're talking about an organization here, the Provisional IRA, who is a murderous organization who can go back to being a murderous organization if they so choose, because they have weapons. And you've already said yourself, Stephen, they're involved in criminality. Are those weapons being used for that criminality? Well, I don't know. You don't know. Nobody knows, but because they're there, they shouldn't be there.
Well, the security services must know. The intelligence services must know.
Yeah, and any political party and any politician should use everything in their power, everything, to get these people to desist.
What are you realistically expecting Michelle O'Neill and Mary Lou McDonald and the Sinn Féin leadership to say about this? Realistically.
Absolutely nothing. They'll fudge it. They'll absolutely fudge it again. They fudge it every single time.
No. I'm not. No, but what are you asking them? What do you realistically think, given what Sinn Féin is? What do you realistically want them to say?
Stephen, I can only do what I can do, and that is be very honest and call out these people and say, this is what you need to do. And that is the leadership of Sinn Féin, both sides of the border, need to stand up and they need to say, if you in the Provisional IRA Army Council still have weapons, hand them over to the police now. Get them handed over. Whatever mechanism it takes to do that, get it done. Now, are they going to do that? I don't think they will, but they should do that, because that's what I would be doing. And that's what I do to every single group that I speak to. And I say to them, please, you need to disband. If you have weapons, you need to hand them over. If you're involved in criminality, you need to stop. If you're targeting people, gathering intelligence, desist from that.
Doug Beattie, thank you very much. We'll pause there. Lots of you calling us this morning, 030 30 80 55 55 is our number. Here comes the news from the BBC. Paul's in Belfast. Mark, we're going to talk about the traffic chaos in a moment or two. Go ahead, Paul.
Stephen, see that fella John you had on there, he spoke well, but see the best way to sum this up?
John who? Did we have a John on? John Mooney! John Mooney from the Sunday Times, yes.
Yes, he spoke well, but the reality is that the Republican movement is now a political movement. The leader of the Republican movement in the south of Ireland is Mary Lou McDonald.
The PSNI.
And the leader of it in Northern Ireland is Michelle O'Neill.
The PSNI's 2024, no. The assessment given to this... The assessment given to this program this morning by the PSNI is that Sinn Féin is controlled... Stephen. By the Army Council.
No. Listen, I'm telling you exactly. The MI5 and the PSNI can twist the words all they want. The Provisional Irish Republican Army is disbanded. It's gone. The Republican.
Not according to the security forces.
No. The Republican.
How do you know?
No, listen, I'm from West Belfast. I know.
All right, you get a wee letter through the door every week to say where the IRA is, do you?
Born and reared in the area. I'm telling you now, the Republican movement is a political organisation. There is no military wing of it. And the leadership of it in Northern Ireland is Michelle O'Neill. She's the leader of it. And the leader in the south of Ireland is Mary Lou McDonald. Two totally innocent human beings that have no criminal records, were never involved in the Provisional IRA. They're two politicians.
It is the assessment of the security forces and the current police force that are on the ground in Northern Ireland.
The assessment is rubbish.
And they are saying that the IRA is storing weaponry. They are saying that they're identifying covert human intelligence sources while they're doing that. And they are saying they're gathering information about dissident Republican activity.
Then, after making that statement, tell them to show the evidence.
And they're saying there are members of the IRA involved in criminal activity, like large-scale smuggling.
Rubbish. Listen, the Provisional IRA is gone. Anybody who breaks the law, who were ex-members of the Provisional
IRA... So why would the police force say this morning? Why would they say it?
Because they're telling lies. They're telling lies. Like, they do lie. Police Service of Northern Ireland and MI5 are a political organisation. Also, they say they're totally independent, but they're also political. Remember, they take orders from the politicians. I'm telling you now that there's only one Republican movement in the whole of Ireland, and it's called Sinn Féin. It's political.
Okay.
There is no military
organisation. Paul, thank you. George is in Derry. Morning, George.
Hello, Stephen.
Good morning.
Yes.
Yes, George, Hello. Go ahead. What's your view?
My view is, Stephen, that you're justifying what the FEC is doing for the UVF and the UDA. And
we're not justifying anything.
Well, you did. You said because in your opinion and the PSNI's opinion that the Sinn Féin had been run by the Army Council of IRA, that it's okay now for the FEC to run
said that. What's the difference in your view?
You sort of justified it. I'll tell you the difference that I have.
What's the difference between UDA, UVF and IRA in your view?
And my that's not why I'm phoning up
there. Well,
I'm asking your view in this programme. Would you not rather open that show with saying we can now walk through Belfast and there's no bombs going off, the war is virtually over.
Well,
would you not rather say that than do your scaremongering by saying that the IRA is storing weapons? The storing weapons, the IRA is making sure that weapons that are out there don't get under the hands of people who's going to do damage to them.
It's getting into their hands, isn't it?
But
what are they doing?
They're disbanded.
Well, hold on a minute, George. Think this through for just one nanosecond.
Yes.
Why are they storing the weapons rather than destroying them?
Well, how do you know they're not going to destroy them? You're listening to the PSNI report. If they told you the mirror was Sunday, would you believe them?
Well, clearly you wouldn't.
Absolutely not.
And Gary's on the Shankill. Morning, Gary.
Morning, Stephen. This assessment, you know, I've been telling you this. Jim Wilson's been telling you it, and others have been telling you this for many a year. And this is going to stick in my throat. But any committed Republican, and the guy from West Belfast is on telling you, any committed Republican and any committed loyalist that had a cause during the conflict, that fought for a cause, would not be destroying their community through drugs or criminality. These are criminals within these communities, and it's down to the police. Until the police start getting help within Republican communities and within loyalist communities to rid these people from us all, then they're not going away. So they're not. They're crime gangs, and they've no place in society. So they have no place whatsoever, but they're not loyalists and they're not Republicans and they're not within some probably are within the ranks of the UVF and the UDN. Some are probably within the ranks of Republican paramilitaries, the IRA. But the leadership doesn't want them. The community doesn't want them. Nobody wants them. And we need the information to be given.
The leadership that this report, which the PSNI has said is still accurate, is a Provisional Army Council, which oversees not just the IRA, but Sinn Féin.
Yeah, and I think you'll find the IRA didn't respond. What the statement in the IRA did give was they were standing their units down. So they were.
Now, that statement does say there's an overarching strategy. This is important, which it is judged that there is a wholly political focus.
Yeah, political agenda, but that wasn't responded. But they were stood down. The statement says they stood the units down, but that's the simple.
Look, the present day question is this. Here's the bottom line: when is there much difference between the UDA, the UVF, and the Provisional IRA in terms of what they do and don't do on the ground? Is there much difference?
My fear would be what Jim Wilson told you. If these people, I know it's, you keep saying it's many decades away, but if these people weren't there, the fear factor would be these drug gangs would completely take over Republican areas and completely take over loyalist areas.
I want to take one more call, and then we'll talk about the traffic chaos that we're all enduring yet again. Stephen and Antrim, last call on this. Morning, Stephen.
Hi, good morning. When I heard your announcement this morning, Stephen, of course, I wasn't surprised. But one piece of information that's missing from all of this, and it's relevant to the security services, MI5 and the PSNI, and us, the public, are the Provisional IRA, through their Army Council, currently recruiting? We've had 9 years since this last assessment.
No, they're not.
Well, they need to make that perfectly clear.
According to the PSNI, they're not. The PSNI have said that what was stipulated in 2015, they are standing over, that all of those main points are accurate today. So that, you know,
And you're telling us, the public, that there is no active recruitment in order.
What bit of this do you all not get? I'm not telling any of you anything. I'm reporting what the authorities are reporting. I am not in the PSNI. I am not in MI5.
You don't need to yell
at me. I'm not in the IRA, UDF, or UVF.
UDA. You're the vehicle. Okay, you're the vehicle, okay? Don't take it personally. But if they are trying to get, as John Mooney said, new forms of weaponry, okay? Who's going to... A weapon is inert. It can't do anything. It's a tool. You need people to use weapons. You need to train people to use weapons. If it is the case that there is no active recruitment has gone on in the last 9 years, the public need to be reassured by that statement.
You're always a good caller, Stephen. Thank you. 030-3080-5555. We'll come back to this if you want to. 9:45. How many of you were caught up in the traffic chaos in Belfast last night? I said this morning, you could get from Belfast to Dublin quicker than you could get from the top of the Boucher Road to the bottom of it. Guess how I knew? I was in the middle of it. I was actually near wetting myself. Needed to go to the toilet. Top of the Boucher Road. Took me 1 hour and 10 minutes to get to the end of the Boucher Road. My little problems are irrelevant, but what is relevant is that TransLink, so the public transport network, the minister, John O'Dowd, telling us, get on a bus, get out of your car, get on a bus. TransLink had to put out a warning yesterday that their buses were caught up in lots of this traffic chaos. The SLP councillor, Seamus DeFoyche, he may as well move into the Nolan Show now. This is 3 times in 1 week. You were caught up in it too.
Yep, about 7 o'clock last night, I tried to get a 7 bus from Howard Street up the Ormer Road, and was informed by a number of passengers who'd been waiting for quite some time that for almost 2 hours there had been no services running from Howard Street, and instead passengers were being directed to the Dublin Road. So people with accessibility issues hadn't been able to move from the stop because they were still waiting on a bus.
Why?
Well, the excuse that was given by TransLink ticket inspectors on the ground was that there were issues around traffic. I think one of the most more considerable areas of frustration was that there was no proper information on TransLink's app in relation to that, and no proper updates for passengers as to when things would either restore. We were told that the issue was that buses couldn't get down Bedford Street, and yet in the 15 minutes that I was there, there were at least 8 buses with either no service on them came past, or quite a significant number of 8 services, which go from the stop just down the street from the 7 service. So there were clearly buses coming through, but an issue around the 7 service. And I know this has been a problem over the last while in terms of Transit effectively ghosting people, that they're saying that services are going to turn up, but then they're not.
Well, meanwhile, here's the glossy approach from TransLink.
Hello there. Welcome to Travel with TransLink. Here are some great reasons to travel with TransLink. Public transport helps you avoid traffic and gets you to your destination quicker. Choosing public transport reduces traffic and congestion on the roads. We look forward to welcoming you on board soon.
But it doesn't, Mrs. TransLink, does it? It doesn't help us avoid TransLink. If the buses are now sitting, avoid traffic, if the buses are now sitting in this mayhem, it just doesn't.
Well, I think we have to be very clear here that the creators of the problem are not TransLink. It is the Department for Infrastructure. It is the fact that Belfast has languished behind in terms of some of the plans that are already on paper, that already have the sign-off of people like Belfast City Council and others to advance better public transport in the city, a prioritisation for buses, and to try and get people out of private cars and onto better public transport. So I think the minister has to get involved here and actually help to deliver some of those plans, push some of those things forward.
Well, he is doing, isn't he? And to be fair to John O'Dowd...
No, I don't think he is.
Well, what he's essentially saying, Seamus, is short-term pain for long-term gain. He's saying, look, we're developing this transport hub in the centre of our city. We need to update the roads, but this is going to provide Belfast with this exciting modern-day future.
But we've heard very clearly what he said in the Assembly, which is that almost people in Belfast should suck it up and put up with problems. The transport hub is not the main cause of traffic issues within Belfast. Before the pandemic, people in Belfast were spending almost the same amount of time in traffic congestion as people in Los Angeles, the car capital of the world. So our challenge is that we have a traffic crisis anyway. The work around Grand Central Station has exacerbated that, but it is not the primary cause. So we need to actually move forward on things like glider phase 2, like bus prioritisation, like making sure that there are better active travel routes. And I'm also of the view that the way that we fund and support public transport in this place is fundamentally wrong. We look at changes that are happening in the south, where fares are being made cheaper in order to try and get more people using services.
Souter's back on again. Chris Souter owns a business in Belfast City Centre. Yet again yesterday, Chris, and I think from some of the people talking to me, what they're worried is that this becomes the norm, that this is now life in Northern Ireland, that you sit and getting from one end of a road, like an hour and 10 minutes from one end of the Pouch Road to the other, is absolutely nuts.
Stephen, it's not good. In fact, I left my shop last night about 25 past five, and I had to go and do a house call in Dromore, and it took me an hour and 40 minutes to get to Dromore. It actually took me about 45 minutes to go 25 metres. And Stephen, for me, this is not good enough. And I take on board what Seamus was saying there, that we need to get a fit for purpose public transport system. We need to make it affordable. For me, the main issue with this is, Stephen, that the roadworks, there's been multiple roadworks and multiple road closures happening at the same time. And look, we've discussed this last week on the TV show, and it's a lack of leadership. It's a lack of joint up thinking from DFI and TransLink and anybody else that could have input into this. To work out, right, if we need to close certain arteries...
Well, they're closing the Sydenham bypass, some of it, this weekend again, aren't they?
It's being closed now. It's changed, so for any user that's coming into Belfast from that end of it, if they look up the social media, they'll see that has changed. So make sure you do your due diligence now. But like for us as a business community, Stephen, you know, it's hard to make business work, Stephen. I say this all the time. It's really, really difficult. In some instances, whenever things just happen, see, instead of you referring to me as entrepreneur and business owner, I nearly wish you'd refer to me as mug. Because honestly, see, trying to run a business nowadays, it's difficult. And then when you have your local civic leadership doing stuff like this and causing this issue, which makes it even harder for businesses to get people into the town and spend their money, it's a nightmare.
Right.
Now, as far as I know, Stephen, we're stuck with this now. So I would like the minister and the chief exec of TransLink to come out with some sort of plan to help ease it, to help make it work. But as you've seen from last night, the buses are now not the answer. So, Stephen, I don't know.
Well, there was also a traffic accident last night. So this is why I'm trying to establish, is this the norm for the next year? Will the buses now, is it the view of TransLink? We'll certainly ask them that there's going to be major disruption to buses travelling around Belfast now. You're saying this isn't the first time, Seamus, with some of these bus routes, right?
Yeah, I've been contacted by quite a number of people over the last year, really, to say that they have effectively been ghosted by TransLink, that they've been waiting on stops, particularly on the 7, then the 6 routes. And the information on the LED screens has suggested that a service is coming. The information on the app has suggested that a service is coming. And yet then nothing turns up.
Edmund in South Belfast. Morning, Edmund.
Hiya there, Stephen.
Go ahead. I'm going to have to carry, I don't know, what do you call those things? A shiwi or whatever. I'm going to have to carry something. There's no way I can, I don't even know what they are. Are they a wee portable? Well, the name gives it away. Oh, they're for women, are they? Well, what's for a man? I can't sit in traffic for an hour and a half now if I need to go to the toilet. I can't do it. Go ahead, Edmund.
Even I spoke to you several times. I'm a taxi driver, right? I'm the guy with the wheelchair accessible taxi, which isn't the wheelchair accessible taxi, apparently.
Yes.
I'm still waiting on you sorting that out.
Yes.
You said you would.
Yes, I did.
It took me 55 minutes to go from York Street to Sandy Row last night. Now I'm a taxi driver. My passengers go out and walk. How am I supposed to earn a living in this city?
An hour from York Street to Sandy Row?
It's common sense. If you limit the availability of lanes for traffic to drive in, that causes congestion. Great Victoria Street used to be 4 lanes. It's been reduced to 2. Dublin Road used to be 3 lanes. It's been reduced to 1. You cannot turn left from Hard Street onto Great Victoria Street. You're expected to drive up the Grosvenor Road. Or you have to turn right to go across towards Millfield until you can manage to do U-turn and come back down Great Victoria Street. What monkeys dream this system up? Do they actually drive cars? Do they actually know how traffic works? They've destroyed our city centre.
Well, they're trying to get us out of our cars. This is the point.
Stephen, I live in Ballinafire, right? That Wormer Road is a car park. From Carry Duff to the town, it's a car park. Because you're not allowed to drive in the bus lanes. There's no buses in the bus lanes. This would be brilliant if there's a bus every 2 minutes going down that road. There isn't. So their strategy doesn't work.
Colin Neal. Colin, we're 68 days from Christmas. You're from Hospitality Ulster. That means that we're getting close to the season where people will be booking. My lot here are already trying to book a Christmas party where there's something like cabbage soup and, you know, turkey isn't. Parsnip soup and all this. So people will be booking Christmas parties is the point I'm making, Colin. We're getting very close to Christmas. You think of the traffic, the shopping, the traffic into Christmas parties, the traffic into shopping. Is Belfast, the capital city, going to be able to cope with it, or are businesses going to go under because of it? Because people aren't going to go anywhere near it.
Stephen, look, you mean, obviously we're seeing increased incidence of traffic problems, and that really is worrying, because as hospitality, we're not just about your party. We're about when you go shopping, you go for a coffee, you go for lunch, you go on for dinner after you shop. But look, I think we have to maybe step back one and say we can't blame TransLink for all the woes of our city centre. Yes, there's been disruption connected to some of their stuff. And look, I totally get TransLink approach about we need a modal shift. I think we're all starting to realise that. But the reality of life is that's not going to happen in the lead up to Christmas.
So what are we going to do?
We need to look at anywhere we can take pressure off at the minute. I'm old enough to remember we used to have a moratorium about any roadworks in the city centre or Altelia routes in the Christmas period. Why is that not in place? Is it in place? Can we get, you know, roadworks delayed, the like of the Sydenham bypass? And accidents happen, and that then, even before anybody was doing this work, when you had an accident in Belfast because of...
This isn't about an accident, is it? It contributed to it last night, but this is about roads being closed, roadworks shutting down lanes, all at the same time. Seamus?
There's a big challenge in terms of a number of projects that are taking place, that things that were delayed as a result of the executive being down for so long over the last 7 years. So there's still a backlog of issues. I think probably what we're seeing is some of those things being kind of caught up on, and that is definitely causing problems.
Right.
But I do have to push back on the issue around what Colin said around modal shift. Every city in the world where we've looked at increased support for public transport and active travel has seen a big benefit in terms of small business income and intake, and also for hospitality. So actually, if we want to do something to support small businesses in this city, and a really great example of this is Open Botanic, which takes place every year in Botanic Avenue. The street is thriving. All of the small businesses there benefit from having loads of people coming down for the day.
But if I can
those things
there,
can really make a difference.
Yes, Colin.
Okay, Commander. I actually said I understand modal shift has to come. What I've said is it ain't going to happen in 8 weeks to Christmas.
So, Souter, you know, what can we do? Look, presumably this is a question John O'Dowd's asking himself and of his departmental advisors. What can we do in the short term in the run-up to Christmas?
That's the exact question.
Yes, I want to make the point that I feel that it is just peak times too, Stephen. So from a retailer perspective, speaking to the general public, guys, please still come into town just outside of peak hours and I think you'll be fine. But dealing with the peak time stuff, Stephen, I honestly don't have an answer. And I've been racking my brain over this. And I think Colin actually touched on it. Do we delay some of the route works? Like, can the minister come to our rescue and say, right, well, we need to stop that? Like, maybe the Durham Street thing.
Well, that's going to cost money, isn't it? Delaying road works.
But here, what's going to be the fallout on the other side, Stephen? Because business is going to get it really tough this Christmas. And Colin also made a good point there. Having this happen on the run-up to Christmas is just, it's terrible. I don't know who came up with this idea. This is, again, it's a lack of leadership at the top of the table. I don't know, Sim. I don't know.
So are you saying that you think it's feasible, it's realistic to say to them, look, stop the roadworks in December? Is that what you're saying?
I think I would like the leadership across DFI and the Permanent Secretary and the Minister and Transit to say, look, we got this wrong. I think they're seeing the bottleneck now. It's too much for Belfast City to deal with. We got this wrong. We need to stop. We need to look at what's going on here. How can we fix this now and make it happen within the next week, Stephen?
Graham's in Belfast. Morning, Graham.
Good morning, Stephen. Stephen, I think your listeners should know that journeys prepaid on a TransLink card can expire. My wife got onto a bus with Journeys prepaid last week and was told by the driver that the card had actually expired.
If you've paid
it was prepaid, bought and paid for, and basically the card has gone out of date.
Why are they doing that?
Well, I don't know. My question would be, does this happen in every other major city? And also, could they change this current problems with the roadworks?
Okay.
Could they change this policy?
Graham, thank you very much. Thank you, Seamus. Thanks for coming in this morning. Thank you. 03030 80 55 55. It's a Nolan Show from the BBC. And here comes the news. Oh, just give myself a wee stretch. Some of the cinemas are putting beds into them. We're going to talk about that later on. I can't think of anything better. Getting into bed, going for a wee sleep. Never mind the movie. Right. Who have we got? Lots of you is what the answer is to that. Kevin in North Belfast. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Kevin. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. I can hardly remember my own name anymore, and you don't know who you are.
that's the way it's going in this case. I was just wondering, why are they doing this time of year? Can you ask a question to somebody?
Well, they're shutting down one of the roads. Which road is it they're shutting down for the whole year? So you can't... Durham Street.
No, but there's a time of year when the schools are off, the traffic's lighter. And this is the busiest time of year for shopkeepers in Belfast. I don't even think I've consulted the business community in Belfast about this. And it seems an obvious help to open up the bus lanes. If not the general public, at least the taxis, to ease the congestion when all this is going on.
Well, if you are an ardent motorist, if you give up and you say, right, I'm leaving that car at home, and I'm getting on the bus. If more and more and more of us did that, and that's what the authorities are asking us to do, then actually, do we need to think about that now?
Well, am I going to sit in a bus for 2 hours, waiting on a bus for 2 hours, according to some of your callers this morning, right? And
You're not going to wait in a bus for 2 hours, are you?
It's a temporary issue where the buses aren't, the transit are giving out warnings that their services are delayed because of traffic congestion. People are wanting to Belfast to shop, to spend money, to keep people in jobs that we need at this time of year. And there was always
Have you got caught up in it?
I've been caught up in it. I've given up and walked. I live in North Belfast. I walk from the town out to North Belfast, try and wait for an hour on a bus.
So that's your experience of public transport? You're just waiting?
Well, sure, it's everybody's at the minute. Anybody tells me they're getting on a bus in time,
okay,
I'll pay money to find out where it is.
Kevin, thank you. Robert, the taxi driver, my goodness. 7 minutes past 10, he's up early for his routine this morning. Good morning, Robert.
Stephen, see, all joking aside,
yes.
You know, it makes a lot of common sense. See the Boyne Bridge? Open up the Boyne Bridge and then start again in January. Now, to be honest,
that's
with
Durham
me,
Street. That's shut for a year.
Yeah, 100%. But we're coming into a busy period. We're coming into a Christmas period. Everybody knows January is a very, very quiet month for everybody, all businesses, taxi drivers, right across the board. Why don't they open up, show a bit of the department, whoever has the power to do that, whether it's the Department of Infrastructure, Minister, open up the Boyne Bridge and then start work again in January on it when things are quiet. And that's a wee bit of common sense. Now, the other side of the coin is, Stephen, the reality of the situation here is, including yourself, the mindset of the public, you're never, the male and female here love their cars. You're never going to get people out of their cars, Stephen. No matter what the Department of Infrastructure try, I actually do believe if they even created free bus service and train service, people will still get into their cars. People actually get into their cars and drive around the corner into the shop around the corner.
Yes, I do that.
Awkward.
Absolutely.
You know,
I do.
Yeah,
that.
Well, absolutely. That's why they love their cars.
I would get a trip from the top of the stairs to the bottom of the stairs if I could. Mr. McDowell, good morning. Good morning. Mr. McDowell has fallen asleep. Dan in Lisburn, good morning.
Good morning, Stephen. Stephen, I know that the traffic is a real pain in the backside for those people who work in the city. But the positive thing is, it's just the city's booming. And I know Mr. Souter. I've been in business since I was 18 years of age, and it's not easy to do a business. But I was in Belfast on Wednesday, and I passed the Ivy restaurant at 4 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon, and there wasn't a spare seat in it, and everybody was having a great time. So I think we're now post COVID, and people are things are coming back to normal.
Well, it's not normal. It is not what we are seeing around Belfast at the moment. There's no way it's normal. Pat, the taxi driver, I keep harking back to just because it was my most recent experience. Like, we all know that Boucher Road area. It was like all the cars from planet Earth had been planted in it, and none of them were moving. It was crazy last night.
But that's because you were stuck in the middle of it, Stephen. But it was the same all over. We had one driver here, Sean, that picked up a patient from the cancer centre over to East Belfast. It took him 2.5 hours to get from the city hospital to East Belfast to go home to Andersonstown. 2.5 hours, Stephen.
2.5 hours.
2.5 hours. The thing about it is, I'm sitting now at the city hall. There's 8 buses in Donegal Square East. There's 10 buses in Donegal Square West. It seems as if these buses and their coaches, now private coaches and metro cabs, it seems as if they're not going to the station. They're parking around the city centre and it's causing congestion. I told you last week that putting taxis into the bus lanes wasn't the answer. Taxis aren't causing the congestion. I think that one of those gentlemen that you were speaking to there hit it on the head. Open up the bus lanes to all traffic until these road works are finished.
But that would be counter to public policy, which is encouraging you to get out of your car and look, the buses have priority in the bus lanes. Not taxi drivers like you, buses.
No, but Stephen, it's the normal person coming into the city centre who's trying to do a bit of shopping or trying to get home after a hard day's work that can't get home. I remember the Lord Mayor of Liverpool, I think it was, saying to you that Belfast was too small for bus lanes. I recollect he said that, you know, Liverpool did away with them. Open up the bus lanes to everybody, let the lorries and everything, and you'll get the traffic moving.
You go up that just Dublin Road. You go up the Dublin Road, right? Excuse me. So you go up that Dublin Road, and you've got a cycle lane, you've got a bus lane, and you've got one for the traffic. Now, how many times is a bus going up the bus lane? How many times is a cyclist, the wee cyclist, going at 2 miles an hour up the cycle lane?
The delivery guys I see using it on the bikes, that's the only bikelists, as I call them. But, Stephen, that bus lane, as you know, we can use the bus lane, but the lane for normal traffic is putting you into Donegal Road. So they have to indicate to get in the lane to take you up the Lisburn Road or Malone. It's an accident waiting to happen. These civil servants are sitting designing these things, Stephen. And they've never, I don't think any of them drive cars or drive taxis or anything.
They're clearly caught up in the traffic too. I think the question for John O'Dowd, our minister, is there any more new thinking? I know that he's looking at some of the bus lanes being accessible to some of the taxi drivers, but is there anything more, John, that you can do to help us get to and from work in the mornings? 2.5 hours, as Pat was saying there, to Andytown from the centre of Belfast. You could go to Dublin and back. Nearly as long for that. And the train. Walter and Maura. Good morning, Walter.
Good morning, Stephen. Sorry to hear about you all driving about your road.
Yes.
If you're driving from Belfast to
Moira.
You could actually wait an hour to get up the main street. About a mile up the road, you could be sitting an hour every day.
Well,
both ways, in and out. You know, to be quite truthful, I've heard all this business about Belfast. You just don't think of the people who are living outside Belfast. You just don't give a hoot. And that's all you're doing. You're sitting in your wee car, God love you, for an hour or 2 hours for maybe one stop.
Yes.
People are doing that day and daily in Moira.
So what's the answer?
The answer is...
Move out of Moira for a start.
Well, somebody said here a good thing here the other day to me. The best thing about Moira is the road out of it.
I'm joking. I'm joking. I'm sure it's beautiful. All right.
I know that.
Walter, thank you, sir. Thank you for coming on this morning. Now, next, the chief exec of InvestNI has told the Stormont Committee there's no evidence yet of any foreign direct investment in Northern Ireland as a result of dual market access. This is Kieran Donoghue, facing questions from Stormont's Economy Committee about the number of projects InvestNI has attracted, what their motivation was for investing here. Dual market access is a consequence of Northern Ireland's Brexit deal. It means that Northern Ireland manufacturers have better access to the EU single market than firms based in GB, while also retaining full access to the UK market. The DUP MLA, Jonathan Buckley, asked if there was any evidence of attracting foreign direct investment of unique dual market access.
Not to my knowledge at this point in time, not yet. So I think there is still a relatively low level of awareness of the opportunity represented by dual market access. So in recognition of that, and following discussions with our colleagues in the department, we've set up a dedicated team within InvestNI focused in on the issue of dual market access. As I speak, my colleagues in the Minister are in Germany highlighting the dual market access proposition to investors in Germany. So I would expect on foot of that trip, we will have a much better understanding of how the dual market access proposition is perceived, at least in that marketplace. And I think over time, as awareness of the dual market access opportunity increases, that there will in time be FDI opportunities.
That man's got a very soothing voice. Paul Grocott, hope I'm pronouncing Paul's name right, an official from the Department for Economy, was also questioned and told politicians it's difficult to say.
I think it's at an early stage whereby the exact relationship between goods moving between Northern Ireland and GB remains evolving and uncertain. So until that's settled, it's very hard to pinpoint exactly how a business exporting or looking for investment could directly be attributed to those trading arrangements.
Well, the TUV MP, Jim Allister, has been champing at the bit to get on and talk about this.
Well, I'm tempted to say, I told you so, because when we had all the hype from presidents and prime ministers about this fiction of dual market access, I said it was no such thing. And it's no such thing for this very simple reason. Whereas there now is no international customs border to trade with the Republic, there is an international customs border for trade coming from GB. So there is not an equivalent dual access. So it's no surprise to me that when direct foreign investment companies look at Northern Ireland and they think, okay, good, we can sell goods into the Republic. But then they ask the question, what about bringing in the raw materials from the main market, GB, and they discover, oh, there's an international customs border there which is going to impede that. So naturally they conclude, no win here. And
surely,
that's exactly what we're saying.
Surely, Jim, the jury's still out. It's inconclusive either way. Is that not fairer?
No, there's been 4 years of experimentation with this. It was 2021 at the beginning of January that this came in. And we were told by prime ministers and presidents of what the wonderful, glorious, unique opportunity it was. And of course, it turned out not to be so. But the other interesting thing, Stephen, is this, that the one sector of the economy which has been growing is the one sector not affected by the protocol, namely services. Services have been going forward with great encouragement, and they're not in a dual access market. They are not controlled by the protocol. They, in fact, are part of the integrated economic market of the United Kingdom.
Forgive me for being a cynic sometimes to what you might say, because you might have, you never know, a Brexit agenda. What surely we would need to look at is how services have done elsewhere in the UK, elsewhere in Europe, post-Brexit, post-COVID, to establish whether it is a Northern Ireland phenomenon that you're suggesting it is.
Well, I don't think I did actually say it was a Northern Ireland phenomenon. I'm pointing out that there are two sectors of our economy. The manufacturing sector, under the protocol, which was supposed to be given this great boost, and the services sector, not under the protocol, and the one that's growing is the services sector.
Jim, the other thing that hasn't happened is Northern Ireland hasn't imploded after this RAC border has been in place. The doomsday merchants, maybe some people might think even you're one of them. What's happened? Business continues. Well, Northern Ireland continues to function. Presumably, you've still got your British passport. Is all not well?
Oh, it's far from well. When a part of the United Kingdom is subject in 300 areas of law to foreign jurisdiction. Look, the very simple.
But life continues, and it's not exactly top of the people's agenda, is it? Do you think people are running around furious about this?
Well, I think people who are of a unionist persuasion are right to be concerned, and Democrats should be right to be concerned, that in any other part of the democratic world, you elect the people who make your laws. In Northern Ireland, we elect the people who make some of our laws, but 300 areas of laws are made by a foreign parliament that we don't elect, over which we've no control, but colony-like, we accept and have those laws imposed upon us. And those are the laws that govern much of our economy, our agri-food industry, our environment, very important issues, over which the people of Northern Ireland have been totally disenfranchised because we're not allowed to elect the people who make those laws.
And yet, here we have the Tories now out of power. They thought the RAC border was tickety-boo, and now you have a different party.
Some of them did.
Now you have a different party, the Labour Party, and guess what? They might even think it even more. Keir Starmer might be even more keen.
Doesn't make it right.
It shows a breadth of opinion across different political ruling parties, doesn't it?
An opinion with respect, which is fundamentally flawed. Look,
But why would your British government do that to part of the UK when both of those administrations want Northern Ireland to remain in the UK?
Well, they did that because they had their eye wiped by the EU in a most spectacular fashion, who I'm sure couldn't believe the ease with which the British government rolled over to give them sovereignty over part of their own territory. Look, even the EU treaties have ensconced within them the respect for territorial integrity. Yet the Protocol Windsor framework totally thrashes that. There has been no respect for the territorial integrity of the United Kingdom under the Protocol, whereby we have handed away control over 300 areas of law to a foreign legislature. That's so fundamental in democratic terms that no one who cares about democracy should ever be able to come to terms with it. The bill which I've introduced in the Commons has the support of all Unionist MPs, as well as prominent Tories and Labour and Reform. So it's not all a doom and gloom story in terms of unity of purpose. There certainly is, and I'm very glad for it, a unity of purpose in regard to a bill which will help rectify.
Well, what will it do? What will the bill change?
Well, the bill would effectively get rid of the REC border, and it would do it in a way which would respect territorial integrity, which would make any part of the United Kingdom subject only to laws made within the United Kingdom, and it would provide the opportunity for the practical solution to the border situation through mutual enforcement. Look, internationally, countries trade all the time one with another. How do they do it? They do it by making sure that the goods they're selling to the recipient country meet the standards of that country, and they enforce those obligations. That's how we solve the cross-border issue. Anyone who's selling to the Republic must make their goods to meet the demands of the EU, because it's EU territory, and we enforce that mutually on our side of the border as they would in terms of goods being sold here. It really is a pretty simple international trade mechanism which could have been implemented. The means to do so was in the 2022 Protocol Bill, which went through the Commons, which then Richie Sunak withdrew in the Lords. But the mechanisms are there, and my bill is to bring the debate back onto that on the basis that the present arrangements are not working, they are not helping the Northern Ireland economy, and they certainly are dismantling the territorial integrity of the United Kingdom.
Jim, good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed, sir. Thank you. That's Jim Allister. Paul Gosling is a financial journalist. Good morning to you, Paul.
Good morning, Stephen.
Is the jury still out? Do we need to wait and see?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Investment decisions, major investment decisions, can take years to process, to agree, to look at the business plans, etc. And to be honest, there's so much uncertainty around this. We've had Stormont Down for a long time. And if you were a major corporate, would you invest substantially in Northern Ireland when you weren't certain that the legislative systems were going to still be in place over a period of time? So you've got that. And we still don't have absolute certainty about the future trading relationships between the UK as a whole and the European Union. We've got a new government. There's negotiations about dealing with some of the difficulties in terms of the relationships. And so I think it's not surprising that those investment decisions have not been taken as yet. But there's another thing which is, I think, very important to stress on this, Stephen, which is we've got a lack of spare capacity in our labour markets in Northern Ireland. There was a report recently published by the Ulster University Economic Policy Centre, which pointed out that although there was employment growth in the first quarter of this year, it largely came from migrant workers coming into Northern Ireland. We've got significant skills shortages within Northern Ireland around science, maths, technology, engineering. And if we haven't got the people with the relevant skills here, it's going to be very difficult to attract high-value inward investment into Northern Ireland.
I thought the whole point,
we have to address those skills things as well.
I thought the whole point being made over many years, Paul, was that we did have an excellent skill base in Northern Ireland.
Not across the piece, we don't. We have a shortage in terms of many of the vocational skills. We don't have enough undergraduate places in Northern Ireland. So and obviously the skills demand changes over time. I mean, a lot of the migrant labour that came in the first quarter of this year came into the health services. We simply do not have the number of staff available that we need in our health service in Northern Ireland. And we've got a substantial problem in terms of economic vacancies, a large number of people that aren't working. And that is because we've got problems with the health waiting list. We don't have enough childcare places that we need. So some of these things have to be resolved if we're going to attract new employment to here.
It's really interesting. Short and sweet today, Paul. Thank you very much indeed. TransLink have been in touch with us with all the traffic chaos we're embroiled in. And they seem to have shape-shifted some of their position about the same traffic chaos they were talking about yesterday. So yesterday, TransLink issued a statement saying that the traffic disruption was caused by both traffic congestion and a road traffic accident. Now, abracadabra, within a day, people asking about, is it still worth getting a bus? Are you going to avoid it? TransLink are now saying it was a number of road traffic incidents created knock-on delays for all road traffic, including Metro and Ulster bus services. So they've just completely withdrawn from their statement any mention of traffic congestion. That's their updated statement today. Right, before we go today, do you remember this? Familiar tune for cinema goers, but how would you feel about going to the cinema and getting in to bed? And enough room in the bed for two others. William Hansen, etiquette expert. Presumably you've always dreamt of this scenario, William.
No. I mean, films go on for so long now. I mean, I can see why people might fall asleep, but in their upright chairs is one thing. But getting into bed now, you're going to be asleep before the trailers stop.
And is it, do you go into this bed? Like, is it like seats? Mm. Are you in the bed with two other strangers?
Or do you
what do you mean?
Well, I mean, I don't want to share a bed with a stranger, thank you very much, in a cinema or somewhere else.
Well, all you're doing is watching the movie and eating a bit of popcorn and a hot dog. Well,
long as that's all you're eating.
Well, but this is actually happening, isn't it? They're putting beds in cinemas.
Yes, I mean, look, just nice comfortable chairs, I think, is all most of us ask. I mean, there's a nice cinema I've been to with a little footstool. That's fine. You know, that's okay. I like that little table next to you. But we don't want a bed. I think that's far too much. And also, you know, are they washing the pillows in between? Are you putting your head on when someone else has sort of sweated during a particularly tense horror film and their sweat's gone into the pillow? Who's washing the duvets? Is it new sheets?
You see, it would be the ketchup from my hot dog or burger, whatever it is, that would be on the sheets.
Yes, well, exactly. And, you know, you don't want to be there and sort of your hand brushes past a little remnant of a hot dog or a little bit of nacho or something.
Well, some people would dream about that.
Well, you know, I find in your own home, because it's your own detritus, but I think this is potentially just a marketing ploy. My suspicion, let's talk again in a year, is they won't actually go through with this.
You think? The comfort of putting your feet up, lying back, lovely comfortable pillow, bed's lovely. If I could spend my life in bed, I'd do it.
Well, you could always pitch it, do your radio show from a bed. But no, I think you've...
I think you'll find it's happened one or two times. It's just the BBC don't know about it.
I think you need to stay alert during a film. You've got to sit up. You pay, you know, going to the cinema isn't cheap anymore, so it's probably not going to be cheap to have a bed.
If you were to do it, what should the etiquette be?
Well, leave, you know, do you offer to strip the bed afterwards? Like if, you know, I came and stayed at your house, I might say, would you like me to strip the bed when I'm leaving?
Definitely, if it's you.
Yeah. Do you do that? Do you, if you do make a mess, do you have to tidy it up yourself? Would you pay an additional charge that the cinema's going to charge you? I think it's going to cause more problems. And if you, you know, what happens if you double book a bed? And as you say, you're suddenly got to share a bed with a weird family.
And in all seriousness, like, you know, nothing illegal. But it might attract couples. It might attract a new clientele who want to be a lot more comfortable at the cinema.
Well, yes, it might do. I mean, all sorts of things. Supposedly, I'm told. I keep sitting in the back row, but nothing's happened to me. But you know, things go on in the back row of cinemas in seats. But you know, heaven knows what's going to start happening, and it's not necessarily appropriate to have public displays of affection or anything else, you know, whilst you're trying
to
watch.
Why is everybody linking bed to affection and all of that type of stuff? It's about comfort, is it not? It's about comfort.
Yes, but it's when the lights go down and people think they can't be seen. They think they can get away with it, but we can all hear you.
Brendan's currently telling me he wants to go to the cinema with me now. It's not happening. I'm telling you that. Can't think of anything worse other than going to the cinema with you, William.
Well, the feeling's entirely mutual.
Okay, good to talk to you. Thank you very much. So the beds now coming to cinemas that can fit up to three people. That's the next of it. See you in 5 Live tonight at 10 o'clock. And thanks for your company. Here comes Connor.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.